From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. It's that time of year.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's March Madness here at Northeastern University.
We talk sports with Bill Littlefield. Also today, what role do YouTube and Facebook play in radicalizing violent extremists?
If YouTube were to disappear tomorrow, or Facebook were to disappear tomorrow, these groups would still have places to exist online.
Plus, we'll hear about the first drug to treat postpartum depression that has been approved by the FDA. And what should the consequences be for sex buyers?
And the place that we really need to look at where we make a change on this is not with the victim or the empowered sex worker, but on the other side of the equation and tackle the issue of men's entitlement. Like, what's wrong with men that we want to have sex with people who don't want to have sex with us?
That's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Let's begin with sports today. There's a lot to talk about. Multiple news outlets are reporting this afternoon that Patriots owner Robert Kraft, who's charged with soliciting prostitution, will reject a plea deal. We'll discuss the case and surrounding issues in depth later in the show. The NCAA men's basketball tournament tipped off last night with play-in games, and the first round action starts tomorrow.
Every game, every moment is one step closer to the destination. Are you ready?
Boston's team is ready, or better be. The local entry faces powerhouse Kansas.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's March Madness here at Northeastern University.
Also, while most of us were still sleeping, the Major League Baseball season began in Tokyo.
Oh, that one is smashed. Wow. Tim Beckham can watch it fly. Another home run in Tokyo. My goodness.
Here to break it all down is longtime WBUR and NPR sports commentator Bill Littlefield. Bill, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I'm pleased to be here.
First time back since you retired, so
yes.
We're really glad to have you back.
And it has been a while. I retired at the end of July, so you're going to have to help me out. Now, basketball is the one where the ball is round.
Right? Yeah, that's the one. It's orange.
Right.
It's orange.
Good,
yeah,
got
it's got little black lines on it. Yeah.
No points on the – I got it.
Okay, all right. So now I question my turning to you for expertise on this all of a sudden, but I just – but I just finished my own bracket now, Bill. I like Michigan. I wish I could pick my alma mater, Northeastern, but I'm worried about them. But I understand that you gave up on the bracket game sometime. Just too many busted brackets?
Well,
or what happened?
Yeah, and I had a lot of company in terms of too many busted brackets. No, I think it was finally acknowledging that basically, you know, if I'd picked according to colors or team mascots, I would have done just as well as the allegedly scientific method of looking at records and matchups and coaches and things like that.
Have you been paying attention this season, though? I mean, is there a team that you like?
I pay attention in the sense that I like to watch great athletes do extraordinarily athletic things.
So Zion Williamson comes to mind.
Yes, absolutely. He comes to mind. And the top teams in the tournament, the number one seeds come to mind because they're extraordinarily accomplished over the regular season. So Duke, Virginia, North Carolina. Gonzaga, which everybody used to regard as kind of an underdog back in the day, but now has become a powerhouse.
Right, right. The David is now a Goliath.
Mm-hmm.
And on the women's side, Bill, you talk about those one seeds. You know who's not a one seed this year?
I do, and I don't understand it.
Okay, so
the
it's
world
UConn.
Is tipped on its axis.
And neither does Gino Auriemma, the head coach. He seems not to be too thrilled. Now, they only lost two games. I know that's a lot for the UConn women, but this is the first time since 2006 they have not been a number one seed. What's going on? Is that justified, and do you still like their chances?
I would be the last person to question the science of seeding because I would be one of the last people to understand it. I know they're supposed to do it not only according to your record, but also according to the difficulty of your schedule and all the rest of that cool stuff. If I were Gino Auriemma, what I would say is, hey, I'm going to fall back on the tried and true theme here, which is nobody respects us. Nobody but us thinks we can do it. And he would motivate his team that way, as if a UConn women's team would ever need motivation like that. But hey,
sounds like the Patriots. So.
Somebody hands it to you. Why not grab it?
Yeah. Manufacture the underdog status. Why
sure.
not? So in a different sport, Bill, I mean, I was talking about just a moment ago, that's sort of like a Patriots mantra. The other team that Robert Kraft owns is, of course, the New England Revolution. And the New York Times devoted a big takeout piece to this over the weekend, pointing out that they have not had nearly the success that their football-playing brethren have had. They haven't won a game yet this season. They haven't even been above 500 since 2008. What's going on?
Well, I think probably part of what's going on is that they simply haven't developed a strategy as some of the other teams have. And there are all kinds of different ways to put a soccer team together. One that has worked at least for some of the clubs in MLS is find a superstar somewhere else, bring them in, and excite not only the crowd but maybe your roster as well. It worked for L.A. When they brought in David Beckham toward the obviously the tail end of his career, and it's worked for several other clubs when they brought in guys who have kind of energized the hometown favorites as well as the crowds.
But didn't the Revs try that with Jermaine Jones?
It hasn't been something that worked out. You can exaggerate. It's interesting that you picked the date that you picked to say they've been below 500 for X whatever 13 years, whatever it's been. Because when Steve Nichol was coaching the Revolution, they were quite successful. They made it to the MLS final game, three or four times in a row.
Right.
Didn't win, but came within a whisker of winning. And they were exciting to watch, and they were a very good team in those days. So they're in a bit of a long slump. I think the major reason that the Times decided that they would trot out the story of the Revs still not having a soccer stadium was maybe somebody on the New York Times thought, hey, Robert Kraft is in the news for all the wrong reasons. Let's give him a break and write about how badly he's running his soccer team.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, how charitable, right? Yeah. Well, so speaking of Kraft, we mentioned at the top that he has reportedly turned down a plea deal that would have allowed him to get off of the charge of soliciting prostitution, but he would have had to admit that he would have been found guilty at trial. And he could still face a conviction now, depending on how this goes. How do you think this plays out maybe on the league side, Bill? I mean, will the NFL punish him?
I doubt the NFL will do anything very dire. It's not going to be like Major League Baseball suspending George Steinbrenner for a year and telling him he couldn't have anything to do with the New York Yankees back in the day. The thing that is most discouraging and troubling about this whole story is so much ink has been spilled and so many fingers tapping so long about what Robert Kraft will do and how embarrassing this is for Robert Kraft and the Patriots and the dynasty and this and that and the other thing. And relatively little has been said about the industry that he was caught allegedly patronizing, which is basically a slave trade, where women are being held against their will and forced to perform these various acts. And, you know, this is what the story should be. Hooray for the police in Florida for at least trying to clean this up. And it's hardly an industry that's limited to Florida.
Yeah. No, and to that end, we'll spend probably the second half of this show talking about that with someone who has counseled former Johns and also a survivor of the sex industry.
I'm glad to hear it. Great.
While I have you, though, Bill, I do want to ask you about the other item we teased at the beginning. That was the opening day for Major League Baseball. Doesn't feel like it yet, but it is technically.
It certainly doesn't.
It is technically here, though, and may that just be because the game was played in Tokyo. The Seattle Mariners beat the Oakland A's in Japan. And our Red Sox, Bill, are the defending champs. Do you like that? Do you prefer them to be the front runner that everybody's coming after, or is it better to be the underdog?
Statistically, it's much better to be the underdog. It's very hard to repeat, and there are all kinds of reasons for that. One is, of course, that the chemistry that enables a team to win never stays the same, especially in this day and age when there's free agency and there's much more mobility for players than there used to be. Heck, I'm old enough, so back in the day, if you were on the old New York Giants, you were going to stay on the New York Giants, and the only way you were going to play in another stadium was the Giants moved to San Francisco. And then you had another home stadium to play in. But
sure.
These days, of course, guys change teams all the time. So you have that wonderful magic formula, whatever you want to call it, in a given Red Sox team, you know, a band of idiots a while back and other nicknames
for
other teams.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to sustain it. I don't care how good the general manager is. I don't care how much money the owner has. People move. And so you've got that issue. And the other thing is that so much depends on a manager being able to motivate a collection of guys, and he has only a limited number of tricks in his bag of tricks, and eventually people stop paying quite so much attention to the manager that less than they might have the previous year when things went so well.
Sure, sure.
So
and we've even
tough.
Seen him go on to Tito Francona, has gone on to
yeah,
success
absolutely.
In Cleveland, but eventually
absolutely.
Maybe
and,
just
and
your time I, runs out.
That's a good case to prove the theory. But all things considered, hey, this is a good club. No question about that. They've held a lot of guys, you know, where they were. They ought to be all right.
Okay. You know, you mentioned the Giants relocating. I'm not old enough to remember that, Bill, but I do remember when a 10-year, $252 million contract for Alex Rodriguez was monumental record-smashing news.
Back when $250 million was
yeah.
some serious
money. Remember that
money?
Day? That yeah. was in 2000. So just yesterday, we got Mike Trout signing a 12-year, $430 million extension. It's just a gobsmacking number when you consider we had just seen the record about a week earlier at 330 for Bryce Harper. What does this mean for the market for our own Mookie Betts? That's what I'm wondering as a Red Sox fan.
I have no idea. And I gave up thinking about what these numbers meant a long, long time ago. And when I go to the ball game, I simply watch the extraordinary skills, you know, the shortstop going deep into the hole and then making the throw straight as a string across to the first baseman, whatever it might be. I don't have any idea what it means, but I'm sure Mookie Betts and his agent are thinking about it even as we speak.
I'm sure they are thinking. They're seeing dollar signs.
Absolutely.
In their head. That's WBUR and NPR sports commentator Bill Littlefield. Welcome back, Bill. Thanks for
Thank
being with
you.
Us. Stay with us. Coming up, what role does YouTube and Facebook play in online radicalization? I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Funerals have begun for the 50 people killed last week in the attack on a pair of mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. Six victims were laid to rest today. And we're learning more about how the alleged gunman sought to spread a hateful message. In the days before the shooting, he posted links to a racist manifesto across social media in more than 60 places, according to the Washington Post. He also live-streamed the attack on Facebook, and the video continued to appear elsewhere on social media in the ensuing hours. Facebook reports that the live footage was viewed fewer than 200 times, but the company also says it went on to remove roughly 1.5 million uploaded copies of the video in the next 24 hours. Meanwhile, over at YouTube, Google engineers worked through the night to identify and take down hundreds of thousands of reposts of the video. So what responsibility should companies like Facebook, Google-owned YouTube, Reddit, and Twitter have for this kind of content? And what role do these platforms play in radicalizing people like the shooter in the first place? Let's turn to Joan Donovan. She directs the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. Joan, welcome
Thanks
to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, let me just start with the first part of this. You know, the responsibility of these companies after an attack like this one that we just saw in New Zealand. I mean, does it highlight a profound flaw in the design of social media just at the outset? I mean, they're designed by definition to disseminate information, video content quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that when we were first developing web standards, regulations, and protocols, we weren't really thinking about vulnerabilities. We weren't thinking about the way that these systems would be leveraged to do harm. And that's what we're reckoning with now. We have, you know, really 10 years of social media behind us and a lot of practice. And now, more than ever, we're a tightly connected world. And the way in which these platform companies respond to incidences like these are, it needs to change. And we know now that, especially with this attack, that the perpetrator sought out even mainstream and relatively obscure platforms to ensure that this message would stay online.
You know, one of the things that stands out to me in Facebook's statement is that figure I read earlier about fewer than 200 people seeing online. But still, out of that, Facebook says that none of those users reported the video during the live broadcast. And I know that Facebook relies in part on its community of users to police one another, to report inappropriate content. And I just wonder if that's a broken system, Joan, because the lack of reporting in this case makes me wonder if the people who know how to find the darkest content online are not the ones who are going to help take it down.
Yeah, this is something that I studied when I was at Data and Society. We issued a report with Becca Lewis, was the lead author on this report on the Alternative Influence Network. And we were looking at how certain extremist ideas can live on particular platforms, and then how it gets disseminated has a lot to do with the structure of amplification and the way in which different users will copy and paste and amplify this across different platforms. And the idea that 1.5 million attempts at upload speaks to me that there's all different interests at play here. It's not just extremists that were trying to do this. There are probably news organizations, probably people who are part of the alternative tech free speech movement were probably trying to upload this, as well as marketers, you know, and you know, junk news organizations that knew they could get clicks.
And I say that Facebook claims that 1.2 million out of the 1.5 million were detected right away by their AI algorithms. But that's still a bunch. That's still a few hundred thousand slipping through the cracks and needing to be taken down by people. So there's still some work to do there. And I just wonder if you've come up with another strategy for how companies can prevent this from happening, because it's not the first time, right? I mean, I'm thinking about in 2015, the shooting of two TV journalists in Virginia. 2017, there was a Facebook live stream of a gunman talking about a killing in Cleveland. I mean, this is not a totally one-off thing.
Yeah, we know that from researchers that have studied live streaming these communities that we do see incidences of crime as well as suicides and other horrible incidences of harassment that are being live streamed. And so we know the problem, and these platforms know the problem. The real issue at stake is that there's no sanctions, there's no rules, there's no playbook. And so until we get some kind of playbook in place that says, yes, you must monitor live streams or you must take down content immediately that is violent, you know, Facebook still had to make a choice to take down this content. There's no rule that says they have to. There's no sanction if they don't. And so this is really public pressure that's getting to them, which makes me wonder, where are our legislators? Where is the legislation we need around broadcast that will help us determine what is the right use case here? And the other thing that I often suggest to these companies is that as people learn how to use and exploit, in a lot of ways, social media in order to gain attention, we have to think differently, not just about the technology, but who uses the technology and why.
We're talking with Joan Donovan, who directs the Technology and Social Change Research Project at the Shorenstein Center. And Joan, I'm just wondering, I mean, what would that legislation look like? Because I can see the pushback argument being, look, this is just sort of the plumbing. You know, if somebody makes a threatening phone call, you know, we don't come after Verizon or AT&T, whoever the phone company is, right? So, I mean, wouldn't the platforms here, the social media companies, make the same argument? Well, you can't penalize us.
There are rules against making 100,000 threatening phone calls, right? And so this is part of the broadcast matrix, is we have to actually understand that as things scale, as they reach new audiences, as they break out of communities of users that are watching them and know what they're watching, we have to have different rules in place for when things are touching many, many more people. And that's really a failure of the way in which we scaled the web without scaling it to use the rules that we've already put in place.
So we've talked mostly about the spread of the footage sort of after the fact, or even live in the moment. But what about before, Joan? What have you been able to find out about the playbook, if there is one? Is there kind of a script for how white supremacists or other hateful groups spread their message online and recruit other people to their ideology?
Yeah, there's a lot of researchers in this space, and we often share ideas, and we often share new places that we find where people are issuing calls for violent altercation. Some of these take the form of very grand conspiracies, and so we track conspiracy theories as well as try to understand when people are getting organized for on-the-ground actions. And in the States, we can say definitively that last year and the year before, we saw a lot more white supremacist groups showing up in public places. And they were showing up in public places because they had been meeting each other online and coordinating. And so that is an empirical fact. It's very easy to trace. The issue is the degree to which they're using sometimes semi-private messaging or private messaging, or they're just using the open web but using anonymous accounts. And so the issue here has to do with the fact that there are many places in which these groups congregate, but there's only a few places where they're really able to recruit new people or they're really able to spread their messages to a broader public. And that's where the major platforms come into play.
So if they're using those platforms, you know, the people who oppose their ideology use them too, though, right? I mean, we've seen the counter-protesters have used, you know, Facebook or Twitter or other social media tools to organize. We've seen student organizers after the Parkland shooting last year, you know, make the March for Our Lives, really a substantial political movement in this country with the aid of social media as well. So how do we weigh the benefits and the awful side of social media?
Yeah, this is also one of the fundamental flaws about the way that social media and content moderation has been designed. It's designed to look for behaviors, so all coordination might even look the same. So the coordination of the students in Parkland might look very similar to the coordination of a white supremacist rally.
To the algorithm, to the computer.
To the algorithm, to the computer. This is why we need to have some kinds of controls around content, especially when it comes to hate speech, harassment, and incitement to violence.
So what can users do differently? I mean, as I mentioned earlier, there is at least part of what's built into using these platforms is the expectation that as a user community, you will help to police yourself. Mm-hmm. How can people do that better, assuming they want to?
Yeah, I think it's a big assumption that people want to work for platform companies in this position. I think people expect that they get content and it's free of spam and it's free of libelous material and that it's free of hate speech, that it's free of pornography. We do have expectations as consumers on these platforms. And so I think it's really not the user's fault that this stuff is spreading, but there is a weakness in the design of these systems that is allowing groups that want this content to get online to remain online.
That's Joan Donovan. She's the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center. Joan, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
The first ever drug to treat postpartum depression has been approved by the FDA. It's called Zulresso, and it's made by Cambridge-based Sage Therapeutics. The drug is administered intravenously, and the treatment takes 60 hours. But women can see results in just 2 days, much faster than with general antidepressants already on the market. Joining me now is Sage's chief business officer, Mike Clunan. He's on the line from Arizona. Hi there, Mike.
Hey, Callum, how are you?
I'm well, and congratulations on your FDA approval. I've been reading up on the prevalence of postpartum depression, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that one in nine women experiences symptoms of postpartum depression, Mike. So that's a huge number. Is that the pool for your new therapy? Who's actually a candidate for Zulresso?
Yeah, it's a great question, Callum. I think the way we've looked at this market, and you know, as you said, this is the first and only drug specifically approved for PPD. So we're really excited not only for Sage because it's our first product too, but for patients. And the number of patients in the U.S. alone, there's over 400,000 women every year that experience postpartum depression. And what we know is it is the most common medical complication of childbirth. And we think Zulresso has really a chance to change this paradigm and bring hope to women who suffer from PPD and their families.
So that's the promise of the drug. What might be the risks, though, Mike? I know that a small number of women in clinical trials lost consciousness during these infusions.
Right, and so we think, you know, through work of the FDA that we've had over the last several months and over the course of the year through our clinical trials, we feel confident in the benefit-risk profile of Zulresso. And in working with the FDA, as we said, we do have a REMS program that is designed to ensure safe use for patients. So we believe that this product profile, how fast-acting and rapid the product takes effect, you mentioned that within 2.5 days, it's a one-time treatment for patients with PPD. And we've seen in 2.5 days very high response and remission rates for women. And we've seen that benefit actually take place in hours as well. So this is a very much a paradigm shift from what we've seen with antidepressants that might take weeks to months to take effect, if at all.
And then how long can relief last, Mike? And then is it used in conjunction with a conventional antidepressant after the fact?
Yeah, so what we've studied, Cal, we studied out to 30 days of durability of Zulresso. So we studied this over the course of the 60-hour treatment and then followed women out to 30 days, and we continue to see that durable effect and that it was well-tolerated. We also studied that you could come into the study having taken antidepressants and being stable on those antidepressants, so women can continue to take them. But we see Zulresso as a one-time sort of monotherapy is the best use of this product, and we'll see how this plays out in the marketplace.
As you well know, Mike, the healthcare industry has received a lot of criticism recently for very expensive drugs. This one, I understand, will cost about $34,000 for a course of treatment. There could be some discounts after the fact, but that also doesn't include the cost of staying at a medical facility for the course of a couple of days either. So, you know, what would your guidance be to people who are saying, you know, this is just too high? A lot of women won't be able to afford this.
Yeah, Calum, I think the way we look at the pricing is we've really taken a very thoughtful approach to pricing, and our whole pricing strategy is meant to take into account the clinical value that Zulresso will bring to moms and their families, right? This is a very innovative medicine, as we've talked about. It's unlike anything that exists on the market. And what we do know, having talked to both patients and payers, that there is tremendous unmet need that exists with moms today with postpartum depression. Many of them fall through the cracks. They don't know where to go to get the care, and when they do, the treatments are suboptimal. So we think Zulresso really fills a high level of unmet need in this marketplace, and all the research we've done feels that this is a very responsible and thoughtful approach to pricing as to how we've priced this product.
Do you expect that insurance companies will cover it so that the cost is a little bit more approachable for folks who can't just shell out $30,000 out of pocket?
Yeah, good question. We absolutely do. We feel confident in the access of this product. That's really what it's about. Pricing really leads to access, and will patients have access to this product? And through a lot of the work that we've done in the pre-commercial setting, we've engaged hundreds of payers and insurance companies to really help them understand what is the unmet need in postpartum depression, where Zulresso could fill some of those gaps, and then what are some of the hot buttons that they may have. And based on those conversations, they recognize the unmet need, and they see the level of innovation that Zulresso is bringing to moms and families. And we feel confident that we'll have access for patients at the time of launch.
And I understand that Sage has another drug in the works that also will treat postpartum depression, but it would be a pill, and it would be taken orally daily. So what's the target demo for that, Mike? Are these drugs sort of complementary? Are they for different types of patients?
Yeah, so see, you're referring to Sage-217, which is our second product that's in the late-stage trials in phase 3 right now for both postpartum depression but also major depressive disorder, insomnia, and also bipolar depression, so multiple indications here. With postpartum depression specifically, if both products are on the market, if we're fortunate to have both products, both Zulresso and Sage-217, we think there's an opportunity to create options for patients, which we think is a great thing. In a market today, postpartum depression has no specifically approved indications or products specifically for PPD. To have two products, one an IV and an oral, we think there's a great opportunity to provide options for patients. And at the end of the day, you know, with those options, it's going to come down to the physician and the patient making the best choice for them. But we really believe in creating optionality for patients with both products.
Mike Clunan is the Chief Business Officer at Sage Therapeutics in Cambridge. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Thanks, Calum.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Calum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Multiple news outlets are reporting that Patriots owner Robert Kraft has turned down Florida prosecutors' offer to drop charges of soliciting prostitution. Had Kraft accepted, he would have had to make a sworn statement admitting that he would have been found guilty at trial. He also would have had to perform community service, pay a fine, and fulfill an education requirement. Listeners, this is, of course, a sensitive topic that may not be appropriate for all ears, so please use your discretion. A big question remains about what the appropriate consequences should be for people who buy sex. And joining me now is Peter Qualiatine. He's a gender violence consultant and former director of Stopping Sexual Exploitation, a program for men. It's a 10-week program for sex buyers. Peter, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Also here via Skype is Nikki Bell. She's the founder and director of Living in Freedom Together, or LIFT, which supports survivors of commercial sex exploitation and trafficking in Worcester. Nikki, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you as well. What should the consequences be for sex buyers? Do you believe Johns can be reformed by educational programs? Have you yourself bought or sold sex? And are you thinking differently today about those actions? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. And I'll just add that we don't use the full names of callers. And for this conversation, we can also omit the town you're calling from if you need that additional layer of privacy. Nikki, let's start with Robert Kraft and his co-defendants and the news of the last couple of days about this proposed plea agreement that he is reportedly turning down. It doesn't necessarily mean that all of the defendants will. And so, Nikki, I'm curious, what's your take on the deal that prosecutors offered? Does it do justice in your eyes?
I mean, I don't think there's a way to do justice for the harm that it, you know, buying people in prostitution causes. So for me, it's difficult to say like this is justice. I mean, you know, the women that I work with and including myself were incarcerated and served, you know, a lot of time for prostitution related activities. And, you know, sometimes it feels like it's a slap on the wrist for the violence that they're perpetrating on people.
And in the case of Kraft, I mean, there's both the legal case. There's also what could happen to him at the league level if the NFL wanted to take any action. And the National Center on Sexual Exploitation has sent a letter to the NFL's commissioner, Roger Goodell, calling for an independent investigation. And I'll just read a portion of that letter. It reads, quote, "If the results of said investigation show Mr. Kraft to have engaged in the purchase of women for sex, the NFL must banish Mr. Kraft from team ownership because men who purchase others for sex inflict inestimable amounts of human suffering on those they exploit for sex." Nikki, is that what you would like to see? I mean, should Robert Kraft be out of the NFL regardless of what happens to him in court?
You know, I think it's important that we're holding people accountable for the actions that they cause, regardless of, like, you know, whether they have privilege or wealth, right? Because essentially what prostitution is, it's like that's differential in power, right? And so, you know, I think it's important that we're holding people accountable and sending a message that this is not something we're going to accept as a society.
Peter, let me come to you. You know, the men in this case, including Robert Kraft, were facing up to a year in jail before Florida prosecutors made this offer to drop charges with conditions. So I wonder, in your view, I mean, is jail the suitable place for Johns to send a message and both to maybe rehabilitate them?
I think the most important message to send is the conversation that we're having right now. And it's a conversation that's related to the Me Too movement. It's a conversation that's related to intimate partner violence and to other forms of gender-based violence and inequality. And that really fundamentally what we need to look at is changing the social norms that are at the root of all of these practices. And so I think the best part of this is that it's a wake-up call. In terms of the individuals, absolutely, there's programs that that can help somebody who's in a situation like Robert Kraft is. But on a broader level, I think that a post-conviction or a diversion program is too little too late. And so really focusing our efforts on prevention, on working with young men specifically, on understanding issues of mutuality and consent in regards to sexual activity is an important focus of our efforts. So, yes, the surprising thing with with Kraft is that he was arrested at all and that we're having this conversation. Mm. I've been doing this work for 30 years and you know, there's a great deal more buyers out there than there are people who have been exploited by being bought in systems of prostitution. And historically, what's been the focus is those people, right? That the person who's been exploited has been blamed for the harm of commercial sexual exploitation. And so one of the things that I feel pretty good about is that we're starting to see the focus shift. We're starting to see a recognition that this is harmful because it's rooted in inequality, and that, in fact, the accountability for that harm should rest with the buyer.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with gender violence consultant Peter Qualiatin and Nikki Bell, founder and director of Living in Freedom Together, or LIFT, which supports survivors of commercial sex exploitation and trafficking in Worcester. And listeners, again, the number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amber is calling from Watertown. Hi there, Amber. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
What's on your mind?
One of my previous life partners, who I hoped was going to be a life partner, I discovered him having sexual relations with prostitutes. And when I brought it to his attention that they were probably underage and probably had been trafficked here and were not here of their own free will, and that he was essentially raping them, he didn't really care for that commentary.
I can imagine. Amber, thank you for the call. Nikki Bell, does Amber's anecdote sound familiar to you?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have this conversation a lot in our regarding prostitution and trafficking, that like these people are not there of their own free will. And I beg to say that most people aren't there because they're wanting to be or choosing to be, regardless of if there's a third party profiting in this situation, right? I mean, when we're looking at why people are entering prostitution and talking about like the underlying, you know, inequality and vulnerability that they're experiencing, you know, we do, you know, I also, you know, partner with an organization that does a John School. And it's like looking at that, the reality is like, you know, there was studies done by Demand Abolition in different places where it's like, if men show up to, you know, for prostitution activity and they learn that the person is underage, they're still going to go through with it. If they learn that this is a trafficking victim, they're still going to go through with it. Because part of it is about dehumanizing people in the sex trade. So they're not, like, the buyer isn't viewing this person sometimes as an actual person, right? So they don't care about the consequences that it's having on the prostituted woman, because they're viewed as a product or an object as opposed to a human being.
Well, so Peter, is it possible then to shift that mentality? You know, Nikki mentioned these so-called John schools, and you ran a men's accountability program for court-ordered and also self-referred sex buyers for more than 20 years. So maybe you could begin by just describing what that education program looks like. Like, what's the curriculum?
So they vary. You know, there are programs that vary from one day to the program that I did in Seattle, which was 10 weeks long, one evening a week for 10 weeks. And the curriculums vary as well. But I think that something people don't understand about sex buyers is that when most men who buy sex want to stop buying sex. In a recent study by Demand Abolition last year, they looked at men who an anonymous group of sex buyers, about 2,000 of them across the country, and a full 70% of them said that they strongly agreed with the statement, I want to stop buying sex. And so the question then is, why are they doing it in the first place? And most people want to rush to this idea that this is somehow an addiction or a compulsion. But I would say that rather than looking at it that way, look at it as more of a product of what we learn about sex in relationship to what we learn about masculinity. Because when we look at who it is that's buying sex, it's almost exclusively men. And most men don't buy sex. About 80% of men in the United States will never buy sex. But of those who do, of the people who do buy sex, most of them are men. So it has something to do with what we learn about masculinity coming up. Secondly, I think that it's a cultural thing. The culture holds out to men that we can get our relational needs met through non-relational sex, right? That's a mode of proving your manhood to yourself, to your buddies, to the world. And what we know is that it just doesn't work, right? So that they're out there, they buy sex, and they come up feeling shame, guilt, anxiety, but it doesn't stop the behavior, and the culture has not equipped them with the social-emotional learning to be able to really figure out what's wrong. So I think being able to dig in deep with them takes more than a day, takes more than a week. I think the premise that most John schools work on is that the men weren't aware of the harm, but what we know is that that's just not true. You know, like Nikki said, most of them are aware of it. They just don't care. They're selfish, and they don't think of this other person as a person who could be experiencing harm. They feel entitled to do what they want because they've paid the money and because in their mind this is normative behavior. So we need to really reframe this issue and figure out what's wrong with the men. I mean, the harm of prostitution becomes a problem for women and other people in prostitution. But it starts with the hearts of men and with the hearts of the sex buyers. And so being able to figure out what are the needs that he's trying to get to meet through this practice, who does he have in terms of the social support in his life? Because it's not really usually about just sex, right? It's about a connection to a much larger picture of who this person is as an individual.
Well Nikki, so, if I can ask, you know, Peter's talking about these men and how they're not thinking about the women that they are buying here. And we've had some ghastly details in this case, you know, police saying that women at the Orchids of Asia Day Spa, for example, this is the place in Jupiter where Robert Kraft was allegedly frequenting, that they were sleeping on the massage beds that they were working on. They were cooking food on hot plates in an alley. In some cases, they were forced to service more than 1,000 men a year. And then there's also the risk of violence. I mean, Nikki, can you fill in some of the details here so that people really appreciate what's going on in this dark, dark world?
Well, I mean, you know, that's just one example of, like, you know, the violence and, you know, things people are experiencing in prostitution. You know, for many people, again, it's all rooted in vulnerability. So those women were obviously homeless, you know, held against their will. Their immigration status was you know, being preyed upon, right? But there are all different kinds of violence people experience in the sex trade, right? Or different vulnerabilities. We see a lot of young people aging out of foster care system. We see, you know, the violence that people experience in prostitution is horrific. And the reality is, most of it, when you talk to the women, is at the hands of sex buyers. You know, and just the act of being prostituted or you know, being bought and sold is violence, right? So we view prostitution as gender-based violence. Money does not equal consent. So this is unwanted sex, essentially, and somebody handing $40 or $100 afterwards to negate that fact.
We're talking about the consequences for sex buyers, what they should be. And listeners, we'd like you to weigh in. Do you believe Johns can be reformed by educational programs? And have you yourself bought or sold sex? And are you thinking differently today about those actions? The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Deanne is calling from Back Bay. Hi there, Deanne.
Hi. My point is that the prostitution is like a dark market that we cannot monitor, we cannot control it. It's going to happen for a long time. Has anyone thought about what is the pro of having it legalized? Basically, the sex buyer doesn't have to go to the criminal to buy the sex. And also, people, you have to understand that there are people who actually purposely, they want to be prostitute. And we put them in harm by making it illegal. These women get hurt and, you know, emotionally, physically, but they cannot report because they know they did something illegal. But if we can have the program or even discuss about it, we might be able to help some of these people. I'm sure that the sex buyer do not want to go to the black market and pay off the criminal. If we legalize it, then we have a better choice for these people. That's my point.
Tien, thank you so much for the call. So, Nikki, how about that? I'm sure that's an argument that you're familiar with. You know that there are some women in the commercial sex trade who say they're not victims. You know, they maybe call themselves sex workers and would, like Tien, like to see prostitution legalized. The argument being, you know, you reduce exploitation by bringing it out of the shadows. So, how about that argument?
So, when you look at places that have legalized prostitution, it's actually shown to have the opposite effect. Trafficking increases, violence against women increases. And you can't, like, you know, the reality is, it, you know, we should be moving towards decriminalizing for the prostituted person. So making it, you know, essentially they could not be arrested for their own exploitation. And then increasing fines and penalties for buyers. We've seen success in reducing prostitution and helping people exit the sex trade in that way. You know, and the reality is, you know, we're saying that people want to be there, and I'm not, you know, disputing that there are, you know, those individuals that are doing this voluntarily, but most people are doing it because they don't have options or they don't have choices. I mean, how many people did you meet in third grade and their childhood dream was to grow up and be a prostituted woman? I mean, I've yet to meet those people.
Right.
Most people are in prostitution because they don't have other options. And so when we're talking about legalizing it to make it safer, that's actually not what happens. And it's not violent because it's legal. It's violent because it's violence.
So, Peter, I mean, is what Nikki is describing there something that resonates with the men you work with? Because I do wonder, once the men are in your program, if they've already bought sex, I mean, is that person beyond the point of return? I mean, once you see another person as an object to be pot, is there really any amount of education that can unlearn that kind of value system?
Yes, there is. And most of the men that I've worked with have been pretty eager to unlearn that value system and to embrace a value system that's closer to who they might feel they could be at the core of their being. I think that given the opportunity, that most of them will kind of rise to the occasion. That said, they're not a homogeneous population, right? And people who want to do harm to women and people generally sometimes target people in prostitution. So you have people who are serial killers that target people in prostitution. You have people who commit sexual assaults, brutal sexual assaults, that will target people in prostitution. They're vulnerable to those types of violence. And so that type of perpetration, you know, you'll be much less likely to have somebody that could make some real big changes for themselves. But the success that we had with our program in Seattle, the longer-term program, was such that we had a significant group of men that came through under court mandate that chose to come back again through the program voluntarily and eventually trained to become facilitators. So I think that change is possible, and that it's not just going to be about, you know, stopping the harm against people in prostitution, but it's also going to be about enhancing these men's lives and making them better fathers and husbands and community members. You know, one of the comments I got back from one of the men that came through the program in Seattle at the end of it, when we asked him what was going to change in his life because of this class, and he said, "I'm going to change the way I raise my son, because I don't want him to be angry and depressed all the time like I am." And to me, that speaks to the ripple effect that happens when you engage in this type of transformative justice project with men who buy sex.
We're talking about sex trafficking and prostitution with gender violence consultant Peter Qualutine and Nikki Bell, the founder and director of Living in Freedom Together. And if you want to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-423-8255. Josh is calling from the North Shore. Hi there, Josh.
Hey there. First of all, thank you so much for having this conversation. I'm literally sitting in my car saying yes, 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 and thank you. So my question is, I'm a little bit baffled by, I think that the work to fix what's going on with sex trafficking is great, but I think that what we're looking at is a much greater problem. I don't think any young boy wakes up one day and decides that he wants to pay for sex. I believe that being a part of a culture that glamorizes sex and glamorizes the objectification of women over time creates, I think, inside of men, this understanding that I can get what I want, I can have sex when I want. I mean, you see it in the porn industry, just completely blowing up. You see it in the way that, men, when they're not held accountable, treat women. Mm-hmm. But what I'm sort of baffled at is that that's usually not a part of the conversation. Nobody wants to look at how, and I'm not saying this conversation, but I think the overall conversation, nobody really wants to look at the way that we as a culture embrace sex and embrace the way that, men look at women and say, you know, maybe we need to fix this, and then these other things will be fixed along the way.
Got it, Josh. Thanks so much for the call. Nikki, in the moments that we have left, what about that argument that, sex trafficking and prostitution is really just one symptom of, a much broader cultural issue and our total attitudes about sex from a very young age?
I agree completely. I mean, you know, we often, you know, again, culturally, like in movies and, you know, society, we view prostitution, he's right, we view prostitution as glamorous and as like women as objects and, being over sexualized and all of that. And the reality is it's not glamorous, right? And I think, you know, Peter's exactly right. It's prevention. We do a lot of prevention work in like in domestic violence, sexual violence, and, exploitation that is geared towards essentially preventing young women from being victimized rather than preventing young boys from perpetrating, right? Domestic violence, sexual violence, and, exploitation, we look at them as women's issues, but they're men's issues that become our issues.
That's Nikki Bell, the founder and director of Living in Freedom Together, or LIFT, a survivor-led agency that supports survivors of the commercial sex exploitation and trafficking in Worcester. Nikki, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Our thanks also to Peter Qualutine, a gender violence consultant and the former director of Stopping Sexual Exploitation, a program for men. Peter, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.